don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 340, and we're gonna go to Ericus. It's your host, Ify Mwadibwe, and in the booth with me are my friends. So now it's time for me to introduce you to them. First up, we have Alonzo Duralde, Christmas Zaddy himself, fitted in the still suit, eyes glowing blue. What is good?
You have been waiting a lifetime to introduce yourself as Ify Mwadibwe. Admit it. I'll tell you, what's good with me is a show that I have no excuse for being this late in getting to season two of, because I really loved season one, but just somehow life, the world, it all got away from me. Anyway, I'm finally digging into the second season of Schmigadoon, aka Schmacago, and it's just genius. I mean, the Sondheim parodies are dead on, the Bob Fosse parodies are dead on, and there's a whole Godspell moment that I thought I was going to wet myself laughing at, because they really get, I mean, I love Godspell, but I also know exactly what's wrong with Godspell, and they were just hitting all the right buttons on that one. So yeah, I'm only about three or four episodes in, but just loving it, eating it up with a spoon. So if for whatever reason you have not dug into the Schmigadoons yet over at Apple TV Plus, get on it.
I feel like a lot of that show flies over my head because I am not of the theater as some people. However, there was a clip online of Jane Krakowski, National Treasure, doing some kind of real-time take of whatever their version of a modern major general. Like
she was doing Getting Married Today from Company, but it's the same thing. Yes. It's one of those verbal gymnastics songs you have to rattle off a bunch of
I know
stuff,
one of those references. So, but yes, that's what I mean. There's much better ones. But I watched that clip of her three times. I was like, what is she doing? How amazing. Anyway.
Not Getting Married Today is the greatest act of gay athleticism possible.
Pretty much. Yeah. Sorry,
Greg
Louganis.
Both the song and the act. Yeah.
Yes. I think this, Dre, like, you know, it would be the premium way for you to watch it would be like with a gay on the sofa, footnoting it for you. But I think even without necessarily knowing what they're spoofing, it's still fun just because it's funny and the songs are entertaining. There'll be a whole other layer of satire that maybe is escaping you, but I think you'll still enjoy it.
Surprising no one. That's how I watch most things, is with the gay on the sofa footnoting things. Yeah.
As you should.
All right. And that second voice you heard is none other than the queen of the Midi Westerit, Drea Clark, Super Festival producer, programmer. What is good?
If he's never been happier.
Someone did show prep. That's amazing.
We have unleashed the sandworm kraken. Okay, my what's good actually involves a mutual friend of our special guests and I, the Saucy Aussie, one of my besties who lives in Australia. And we were just talking, and first off, she brought up GORP. She's been camping a lot lately. And the concept of GORP, I adore. If you are not familiar, it's either good old raisins and peanuts or granola, oats, raisins, peanuts. It's trail mix, essentially. And as you know, as a camp counselor for years with the Saucy, she did not know what GORP was, but she brought up that she had learned about GORP core, and there's an entire aesthetic now based around that, which was already all of this I love. I'm like, oh, what's good? All of this is good. And then she clued me in that in Australia, they call it scroggin. They call their trail mix scroggin. And if you're like, well, that's silly, because at least GORP is an anagram. Oh, they certainly think that scroggin is an anagram, and it means, wait, I have to find it. This please, I almost sorry. Died. I was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It was sultanas, chocolate or currants, raisins. Basically, the O stands for other, and that's all you need to know about scroggin. Other. Just an entire category of other. Scroggin. Wow. I everything about it, I was like, now I want scroggin core so bad. Sign me up.
I love the idea of GORP core, because it, you know, we are coming up to the 50th anniversary of the Bicentennial, and I really want a return to like horrifying mid-70s aesthetics whenever possible.
It's coming.
There was a teen comedy set at a summer camp called Gorp, which I've never seen, but now I feel like I need to run out and get caught up with that. And I always do remember there was one of the great early Roseanne bits where she talked about how her trail mix recipe was plain M&Ms, those Kraft caramels, and peanut M&Ms.
Would eat.
All right. Well, look, this is a podcast known for its great guest, and today is no different. It is our good friend, writer, comedian, actor, Dune evangelist, Guy Emperor Branham IV.
Hello, Iffy. Good to be here. Yeah, my name means the strength of the base of the pillar. What is good this week for me? I was in a steakhouse and I heard the 1978 Kenny Loggins Stevie Nicks duet, "Whenever I Call You Friend," and I had forgotten that the song existed, and then have now been for a month only listening to that song from that very specific period of time when the cocaine was pure enough that people were producing songs to their purest point. Like, it really is just smooth vocals laid over each other. It was written by Kenny Loggins and Melissa Manchester, and they have a version, and it's not good because it's too smooth. And sometimes you need a chaotic witch on top of things, making things rough, which is why I love that song and Dune.
Stevie Nicks brings the hint of baby laxative to this.
I like to think that Iffy is our chaotic witch. Brings that on top. Like, it's, I get it. I get that whole recipe.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I get that layering of vocals to make something great. My layer pick would obviously be Easy Lover with Philip Bailey and Phil Collins. Two Phils going at it, you know. And there's a helicopter in the music video. You know, it's a good time.
I got to throw out Andy Gibb's Everlasting Love, where the Bee Gees just swirl around him vocally. It's amazing.
Ooh, yeah. Picks, Drea?
No, all I can think of now, I'm on the duet track, so I just got Leather and Lace circling. But, like, that's pretty much a perpetual state for me. Iffy, what's good with you? Other than double fills.
Oh, I mean, what's good with me is, you know, I gotta say it's been a real fun announcement today when we were recording this. But yeah, I'll be performing in London in September at the Leicester Square Theater.
Leicester, babe. You're performing at Leicester Square.
Yep, you know, glad we figured that out before I get there. They're going to boo me off stage because I cannot say the name. I feel like we've had the Leicester conversation before. And there's another weird-ass name because Emma's from Massachusetts. And, you know, they have all those weird fucking names out there. Worcester. And then I said Gloucester. Glockcaster or something. When it was Gloucester or something.
My lamb.
Yeah. Oh yeah. All that good stuff. So I'm gonna have to really hit up the pronunciation YouTube before I head out there. But if you're in the London area,
we're come counting through on you to do your whole set with an English accent. That's really the people want.
You know, we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Just think, how that's would Florence Pugh though, do this?
Yeah.
Congratulations, though. That's amazing.
Thank you. On today's episode kicks off a spice-fueled adventure we're calling Dune Month, where we're going to be talking about David Lynch's infamous or famous, depending on who you ask, 1984 adaptation. Then we're going to pitch our own brilliantly out there pairings of directors and material. But first, it's time for Itadic, our movie news segment where we read the week's movie news and answer that very acronym, is this important, do I care? Drea, why don't you kick that out?
All right, as clever listeners will have already guessed, we are not just doing Dune Month for our health. The occasion is, of course, the release of Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. And it looks like we are not the only ones who noticed that movie was coming out. The film opened this past weekend to $81.5 million domestically and $178 million globally, making it the biggest opening of the year so far. And my favorite, it's the biggest opening, of course, since Taylor Swift's The Eras Tour.
Well, naturally.
Yeah. Is this important? Do you care?
Yeah. I mean, yes, people are going back to theaters and that's always a good thing. And, you know, we talked extensively on this program about how, you know, all the momentum of Barbenheimer got frittered away by the AMPTP for letting the strikes go on so long. So, you know, I'm sure for everyone on the food chain, be it studios, be it theater owners, whatever, like, this is good news.
One of the elements of it it's part of it. So much of what's driving this kind of box office and what also like ups the Avatar numbers, it's playing on IMAX. It's playing on a lot of like large release formats, and those tickets cost more. And that's always funny to me that like, yeah, it's all overall box office. I mean, you pay twice as much to see our movie. Like, we never do how many butts in seats. Nobody's interested in that. They're interested in like, well, this was a 4-day weekend, so we're going to count it as just a weekend. Also, these screens cost a whole lot. I mean, good for them. And he also filmed it to be that, like, his you know, as Marissa's noted, his format of choice is 70mm film. So it's not just a like, oh yeah, we ran it through a, you know, we compressed whatever in post. It was made to be large form, but it does cost a lot. And the people who love that frickin' love it.
Well, and also Marvel was occupying so much space in our movie theaters for such a long period of time. And now that we've hit the point where you are like, Marvel's, is this a movie or is this a television show? I don't know if you guys knew. Not that Marvel's wasn't great. Marvel's very fun. That girl who plays Kamala Khan is amazing. But it's just nice to know that money can be made at the box office without anyone from the MCU having to be involved.
And that's a good point, too. It's been a minute since we had a big-ass movie. Like,
yeah.
It's March. It's been, you know, it's been, oh, it's the, like, vegetable movie awards season. This is stuff that's good. This is cinema.
You know, yeah, like Wonka, I think, sort of, you know, stuck around long enough and definitely did well. But as far as, like, gotta go on Thursday and buy the popcorn bucket, like, yeah, this is a thing.
And it's not in a family's face. Like, this is an adult.
Yeah, it's an R-rated film.
An adult motion picture.
Oh, yeah.
Good for them and good for all those absolute nutters going to the 3 a.m. screenings of this long-ass film. Good for you.
Yeah, yeah. You leave in the AMC. The sun is coming up. Go ahead and get your breakfast popcorn.
I hope everybody concessions was at least earning time and a half on that nonsense, because yikes. Yeah. Speaking of movies, the bootleg Wonka experience is just the gift that keeps on giving, unless you actually bought tickets, apparently. Last week, reports of an unauthorized and seriously undercooked Willy Wonka experience in Glasgow, Scotland, made international headlines, mostly because of just how terrible it was. The images used to advertise the experience to unwitting guests were generated by AI, as was the script actors used for the event. This week, opportunistic human beings have stopped in to make some indie horror lemonade out of these weird Glaswegian lemons. The movie will be based around a character called The Unknown, an evil chocolate master who lives in the walls. Is this important? Do you care?
I care. I'm tagging in here. There's so many things to ping on in this. One, this made such a cultural wave in our world. Like, the inside jokes that have already gone around about this, and like the absolute, like, for me as someone who's been in festival and event production forever, all of us work in spheres that people are like, that's got to be easy. And there's so many examples of, I'm like, oh, it surely is not. But part of it, the idea that this is like, yeah, this does sound like an AI generated script. I'll add, it kind of bums me out. Like, the film team that's doing this is a Scottish film team, which I'm grateful for, because obviously this all went down in Scotland. But, and I'm sure they already had this cooking and made a little tweak and were like, let's call our baddie let's get on this wave, and good for them. It bums me out that the girl who played this is, of course, it looks like the only black member of cast. And the big thing, right, was that she had a mask on and then her like natural hair, and was like the horror. And I was like, oh, God, that that hurts my soul in a little way.
She needs a cameo as the prime minister in this movie.
Oh, yeah. That's all I'm
gonna... They better cast her. I mean, she better be in it in some way or I will be real sad. And that sad Willy Wonka girl. Oh, the Oompa Loompa. That's what I was going to say.
Oh, yeah.
It made cultural waves for us. And then I made the mistake, like I often do, of just casually mentioning it to some of my best friends in Minnesota. No idea what I was talking about. They're like, when were you in Scotland? I'm like, what? Do you not know about the internet? What is happening?
Did they not see the meme of the fake Lego set? I mean, come on.
No memes. No memes ever. Yeah.
That's so funny.
So, yeah, Iffy, sorry, you were saying something about the young actress, because she's only 16, too.
Oh, yeah, no. I was just real hyped when I saw her get the chance to reveal herself and be like, just this poor 16-year-old who thought they were going to make some money and get in there. I was like, what the hell is this? Not equipped. But I will say, she's probably the coolest person at her high school. Or, you know,
girl, tell me everything.
Yes. Well, speaking of movies, AMC Theaters is launching a new Nicole Kidman pre-show spot. Ever since 2021, AMC has been celebrating the fact that 2020 was the theater chain's 100th anniversary. Nicole Kidman's memorable and memeable 90-second video announcing that heartbreak feels good in a place like this has been surprisingly popular and enduring. Now, AMC is rolling out three new versions of the video, essentially 30-second recuts of the original. Among the changes are an update to the movies Kidman is enjoying by herself in the theater, a slight changes to her comments on the power of cinema, and, you know, just to keep things fresh. Is this important? Do you care?
I need new, fresh Kidman content from AMC, and I'm furious that they're just going to rehash this up and throw in clips from, like, I don't know, Guardians of the Galaxy 3 instead. Like, no, that you guys have struck gold here. You need to pay her whatever she wants to make a whole new set of these. Sit her down with Billy Ray again to make another script and do all new entries, because it's the greatest thing to happen to cinema in the last several years. And we can't just coast on it now, AMC. You've got to give me fresh, new, a new Kidman pantsuit. Maybe at a different AMC location where she steps on popcorn. I don't know, but I need more. And I will say this, the celebration of AMC's 100th anniversary in 2020, it's on every pre-roll that they do when they're telling you about, like, you know, where the exits are and stuff. And every time I see that on screen, I just imagine some poor AMC executive somewhere saying, we had such plans.
Right? I'm kind of with you, and also, it's pure lightning in a bottle, the first one. Like, the idea that it took off, both that it is interesting and heartwarming. We've discussed before, like, Billy Ray's involvement in what that added to it of, oh, they're trying to bring people back to the theaters and remind you what's... They do all of these things. But having the imagery and the phrases, and then, most importantly, again, the cultural relevance, like people learning those lines or saluting those lines or recreating them at home, like
putting them on t-shirts,
right? It's like Barbenheimer itself. Like, you can't fake that. Like, that stuff is just, the people are going to do it or they're not. And I'd almost rather have them be like, listen, we're not going to pretend we can redo it. Let's just
remix. Yes.
No, I have such fears about what they will do when they are trying and they know this is a thing. Mm. Like, it really is. I love religion. I love the fact that we now have a bracha, a prayer that we say over the act of, like, enjoying and consuming what a new movie in the theater is. And, like, slight variation where, you know, maybe this time I am not somehow transported. Like, I understand that, like, each different prayer has its own meaning. But truly, the moment she is in a different pantsuit or in a different location, I'm terrified that the beauty goes.
Fair. That heartbreak won't feel so special in a place like this. Yeah. Or feels good. Yeah.
To all our LA listeners, if you start to miss it and you just need a well-dressed pre-show, just come on down to Vidiot's.
There you go.
Where we're not recutting it. We're not recutting nothing. We're giving you the full, long, Iffy Wadi Way experience. Just sit down, enjoy, and get ready.
My only addendum to this is the Nicole Kidman pre-show is a, it really tests my limits of, you guys know, I love when people love things. I want to see enthusiasm and zest for life all the time, have the dorkiest of pursuits and meanings. And yet, when I hear people recite along or clap, it's like people clapping when a plane lands. I'm very like, don't be petty about this, Drea. Let them have their moment. Let them enjoy this. Because I'm like, shut up, nerds! Shut up!
Why you gotta yuck their yum, Drea?
I hold it in. And that's exactly what I tell myself, Alonso.
The clap is now an immediate register for how queer the audience is. Like, it really is just like, how many queer people and women who get it are here is something I learn in those moments.
All right, I've quickly identified myself as a woman who doesn't get it. Damn it.
Oh, man. Okay, well, on that note, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we're learning the weirding ways of David Lynch's Dune. Weirding ways.
Max Fun Drive 2024.
Max Fun Drive? What about it?
It'll be the best time for someone to support the podcasts they love.
Oh, yeah. Drive exclusive gifts, special events, and, of course, all the amazing bonus content.
Yeah.
So, what's on your mind? Check.
Well, it starts March 18th, and it's only 2 weeks long.
And? Check.
Well, what if they miss it?
Well, they should follow Max Fun on social media, or sign up for the newsletter at MaximumFun.org/newsletter, so they don't miss it. Otherwise, checkmate.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Mwadibwe. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Guy Branham,
Alonzo Duraldi.
And we're kicking off Dune Month with the original Dune adaptation. In 1984, nearly 20 years after the release of Frank Herbert's original novel, David Lynch directed today's film, which stars Kyle MacLachlan, Patrick Stewart, and Sting, just to name a few. Strea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Dune?
My sentence to haunt me for the rest of my days. Oh, you mean Dune in its entirety? Sure. So I'm straight up just going to read one from online and, you know, put in some flourish because, come on, let's not kid ourselves. In the year 10191, a spice called melange is the most valuable substance known in the universe, and its only source is the desert planet Arrakis. Right? Arrakis? Yep. A royal decree awards Arrakis to Duke Leto Atreides and ousts his bitter enemies, the Harkonnens. However, when the Harkonnens violently seize back their fiefdom, it is up to Paul, Kyle MacLachlan, Leto's son, to lead the Fremen, the natives of Arrakis, in a battle for control of the planet and its spice. Based on Frank Herbert's epic novel, I mean, like, honestly, the broadest of sketches, because there's everything in this film, to be fair, it continues to be broad, but there's just a lot of it, a lot more broad. How's that? Dune. David Lynch's
We don't
Dune.
Know you're finished until you say the title again.
The Dune movie has begun. I know Guy has seen this before. I think I was the only one, along with Marissa, who watched this for the first time in its entirety. Again, so to those who've watched it before, you feel like it held up? You feel like it's still that good stuff? Did you like it originally?
The first time I saw it was in 2021 when the first Villeneuve Dune came out. I had just sort of missed it all the time. And frankly, I did watch it on my phone on a plane. I'm just going to put that out there. I watched it on TV today, and by comparison, it was a sprawling epic. Yeah, I mean, we'll get into it, obviously, but the thing that strikes me about this movie, especially now after seeing two chapters of the Villeneuve one, is like, this movie is dancing as fast as it can to get all of these stories, all the characters and the plot points and the locations and stuff in. It's just like, bam, bam, and inner thoughts and narration and like exposition, like go, 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 go. We got 2 hours and 17 minutes to do this whole thing. Whereas Villeneuve's like, yeah, I got three movies, maybe more, who knows?
I hadn't seen, I watched part of this one in my younger days and was like, oh, I'm out. I couldn't. I was like, I can't. I made it like a half hour in. And interestingly, I then read Dune. And then, of course, we did the first of the Denis films when it came out. And so rewatching it this time, you know, it really helps a lot if you've already read the book. It really, it may shock you to hear that, but it really informed a lot. But what it also made me cognizant of, that this film, I mean, just in, even on paper, I would have imagined this, because you have David Lynch, notorious weirdo genius, and then this like mythic, dense ass, sort of allegorical, sort of fantastical, like all of these things going on in this text. And then you have whatever studio funded this and was like, we wanted Star Wars. I don't know what you people are doing. And what you get as a result, that half the characters, not half, but a bunch of them are psychic. So the amount of ADR in this film that's either giving you just straight up narration or just being like, you're hearing what someone's thinking as they're staring at someone else. And at least half of those, I was like, that's addressing a studio note. Somebody was like, I'm lost at this moment. So someone's like, okay, you look at him, Paul, and you think, he is the bad guy. And then Paul looks at him and goes, he is the bad guy. Like, it's bonkers.
Guy, tell us everything.
Okay, I saw this for the first time when I was 8 years old. Mm. And, like, Frank Herbert's Dune is jazz played with human culture. Like, it really is this sort of, like, deep, dense, weird game. And the ways that I was seeing edges of that in this movie was hypnotic to me. It, like, it, you know, it made sense as much as anything needs to make sense to an 8-year-old. I love it. I love the 4 different expository voiceovers bouncing into each other. I love that the second half of the movie is like this too detailed story being told by the most non-linear filmmaker we had in 1984, so that the second half of the film is just essentially Kyle MacLachlan repeating the same 4 phrases over and over again. You know, I think it is weird, ridiculous fun, and it really, watching this and then watching Villeneuve's version brought me to the assertion that I don't know if I believe, but I want to test, that good sci-fi requires an element of camp. And I think that this movie is the best of camp, and that to the extent that Villeneuve's Dune survives, it is off of little shreds of camp that it has to use as like parsimoniously as the Fremen have to use water. And all of it, of course, comes from Rebecca Ferguson.
Oh, and Charlotte Rampling, hello.
Oh, yes, hello.
Hello, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie that is, I was thinking about, like, would this movie work if it were a situation where, like, David Lynch got a blank check both financially and aesthetically, you know, like if he just got to make as weird a Dune as David Lynch could come up with. And I was reminded of when David Cronenberg was adapting the similarly hard to adapt Naked Lunch. And he said, if I did an accurate adaptation of this book, it would cost $500 million and be banned in every planet on Earth, or every nation on Earth. And so, you know, I was trying to think, like, would this movie be better if it was just unadulterated Lynch wackiness, or does it only work because it's part Lynch and part studio notes and part like Dino De Laurentiis wanting, you know, bigger, more Star Warsy, you know?
No, I think it demands that you read a book for the first 15 minutes.
And the literal glossary that people were handed in the theaters in 1984, I remember that was a thing. Like, it was a 2-sided sheet explaining like terminology and races and all these things.
There is one thing in this movie that works in an unadulterated and pure fashion, and that is the scene between Kyle MacLachlan and Sean Phillips as the Reverend Gaius Helen Mohiam. Like, I showed it to friends when the first Dune was coming out, and people who didn't know what was coming at them in any way were just like, that's so good. Every line crackles. Every line is a punchline, not in a funny way, but just in like
a rat-a-tat, like...
In the box scene?
Yes, the box scene. Bar scene. Yeah. The Gomja Bar. Like,
I have one of those. I know what they are.
Like, they tried and failed. They tried and died. Like, are you suggesting that a Duke's son might be an animal? I am, like, suggesting that he might be human.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so good.
Yeah.
And that scene also does the rare thing that this film is not always successful, is that I know both the what it's suggesting in a fantastical way that this box can do. Like, it's telling me, like, oh, you are feeling pain that you've never felt before. And it's not in a comical way. Like, there's a lot of things that I'm getting. Like, the whole process of how the spice works to travel people through folds of time could be amazing. And instead, it is like the most incredibly stupid looking manatee kind of thing with like a flaming vagina that shoots a portal through. I was like, what the shit am I watching right now? Is this legal? Like, and then I only again really knew that what was happening because I have read it since watching this. But the box scene, you're so right, was this is humans in quotes interacting, and I know what's happening and the dialogue crackles, but it still has this like, oh, it feels grand and epic even though it's just in one space. And again, that is a lot for anyone to take on knowing the source material, but this one and the comparison here too, because we did talk about the first Dune we're ending this month. We're gonna be talking a lot more Dune. We're doing it, as we've said, but we're ending it with Dune 2, which isn't even all that's in this David Lynch version, right? Like, that they packed in the whole shape of both what it looks like to get them there, what it looks like with this, you know, assassination, what it looks like with the fleeing into the desert, what it looks like when, this is, I definitely remember when I rewatched it, I was like, how did I block out that his mother drinks the water of life? She, what's the Ryan Murphy, the one with the witches? American Horror Story Coven. Like the Supreme in the Coven, like there can be only one. And so old Reverend Helen dies as the new mother ascends. And then there's just honestly a 15-second voiceover and then superimposed over this image of kind of a graphic fetus looking thing. And the voiceover just simply goes, with the water of life, you know, Lady Jessica's unborn baby is now imbued with all of the powers of all of the Janet Bezit or whatever it is. And I was like, and then they boop to a next scene. I was like, what's that then? Who shot who in the what now? Are you kidding? It's like this entire, I'm like, wait, what is that creature? It's a human? What is happening? It's so much. And it's just in like a 30-second voiceover.
Yeah, the clip notes of Dune. Okay, Ify, you're a Stone Cold super nerd. Tell us your take on a non-Timmy Dune adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think I like the fun that was had with it. I think there was, you know, this, it was trying to be this like very out there. And like Dune as a book, you know, even in like I've read the book and watching both movies, it's interesting the directions that both directors took, because Dune kind of feels and reads like a pretty straightforward sci-fi. I feel like everyone tries to extrapolate this like wildness to it that I'm like, oh, it feels like you could just kind of be straight up, like the still suits can look like spacesuits, the sandworm can just look like a giant sandworm, it doesn't need to have like, you know, the booty hole orifice,
the butthole cut.
But there was a lot of things I thought were really cool, like the little, like the way they did the training scene at the beginning with those like boxy, you know, I was like, oh, I just know this banged when you saw this back then, when you're like, oh, damn, this is crazy looking. And just that weird Bebo alien in the wetness that was like, yeah, and you got to kill Paul too. It was very fun. And I think I do enjoy this, and I enjoy both versions because of just the swings that both of them are taking. And I can see the vision. It is funny to me that Dave Lynch was like, don't put my name on this anymore. Because it's like, no, it's a...
Only the TV edit is the one.
Did you just call him Dave Lynch, by the way?
Because we're close. We're close like that.
Can I throw it back to Guy in that twofold? One, when you joined us for The Whale, I very much loved your paralleling the Baron to a lot of, like, visuals of that. But my side note is I could remember that guy and his disgusting skin, but had entirely blocked out that the true mark of the evil planet is that they're all ginger. That did not register with me in my youth. And when it came on, I was like, oh my God, is what there's tying them together? Is they're all red hair? And they were like, well, they need to all have red hair. That's a thing for sure. For sure. That's a thing. But also Sting has to be fucking hot. What is the exact level of ginger to give him where he's still bangable? I died. But Guy, please give us the Harkonnens.
It's so interesting because both of these movies are using like same-sex eroticism and fatness as markers of unnatural, disgusting, hedonistic evil. But it's so much more fun in David Lynch Dune. Like you just, Kenneth, what's his name, is having so McMillan. Much fun with the, he's having so much fun with the Baron the whole time.
And his pustules. Like,
yes. And it manages like on a pretty cheap set with a couple of, you know, hairless cats and some little people to like give me more than, you know, all of the gigantic stadia of Dune 2. I think the compromise that was made in putting Stellan Skarsgård in a fat suit comes out in nobody being able to have fun with the Baron Harkonnen in Villeneuve's Dune. Like, you barely saw him in the first one, and in the second one, I thought it would get a little something. And not so much, but that's a spoiler, I'm sorry. But, like, I just really love how juicy, literally and figuratively, this Baron is. And in sort of like an amoral story, like Frank Herbert isn't telling you about little hobbits going up against like an evil all-seeing eye. It's just two groups of people who are vying for power in a world full of power. And like the sense of like the Atreides being ordered and the Harkonnens being chaotic comes across really beautifully in these performances.
Yes.
I like that. I like that as a descriptive for them as people as well. I hadn't really clocked. It works on levels. I'm hearing.
I can't help but think about like the context of this movie. Definitely a post Star Wars kind of like, let's grab everything that seems remotely Star Warsy and option it and try and make it into a big thing.
Yeah.
That same Christmas of 84, we also got 2010. The Year We Make Contact, which no one necessarily thought was a good idea, but after Star Wars, they were like, what if we just, we own this, we can make a sequel. This time I was also, when I was watching it, I kept thinking about OPEC, which for those who don't know is when basically all of the Middle Eastern oil-producing nations got together and told the West, you're paying, and you're paying richly for this, or fuck you. And, you know, when Paul says, you know, whoever destroys a thing can control a thing, you know, there's so much Middle Eastern, like, language in these movies, the whole Muad'Dib mm-hmm. and all the other things, even though in both cases the casting tends to be real white. but, you know, I at least thought that, like, for audiences in 1984, they were still sort of reeling from what happened to oil prices in the 70s, and I think that's a valid kind of metaphor for this movie to attack. Does it? A little around the edges, if you're paying attention, but I think that was in somebody's mind.
Well, somebody else could have made a movie that would have really connected that. It wasn't going to be David Lynch.
No.
We call him Dave here. Just Dave Lynch. Yeah. No, I agree. And it's also funny to me because I can fully picture the development exec that brought this to the studio. And that development exec was probably a big fan, had read whatever. And then in their pitch, they were just like, oh, it's Star Wars. And then everything that any exec or anyone in charge was like, I don't get this. They're like, did you get R2-D2? Did you get... Do you know what I mean? Like, do you know what the Force is? And that, like, even the fight scene that Iffy was describing, all I could think of, like, if you take away the really, like, super scrapped down, rudimentary looking, it's not even CGI. It's just a very funny, like, wash they did on them to box them in as they're doing... It's the most stationary fight scene you've ever seen. It's like two people trying to knife each other that I'm like, you're both dead. You both died immediately. And
it was 1984 state of the art, though.
Right. That's true. But in my head, those actors were in that set. Like, the set's gorgeous. Like, the stuff that's there, they're in their weird-ass suits, and they're like, all right, this somehow worked in Star Wars. We're gonna put our faith in the Emperor, as it were.
Is the real villain here Mel Brooks? Allow me to explain.
Oh, Alonso, I know where we're going. This. Go ahead.
Like, that Mel Brooks hired David Lynch for The Elephant Man, and David Lynch stayed on the leash. He gave him a Victorian movie with some weirdness, and was it, like, could no one have expected that he would Lynch this hard, given his first real opportunity so to do?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the productorial career of Dino De Laurentiis, you know, this is the guy who saw Jaws and thought, oh, Orca, you know, and King Kong. This is a guy who thought, like, Barbarella and Danger Diabolic were going to be, like, you know, global hits, which, I mean, I guess to some extent they were, but, like, they're bananas. So, like, his taste level is not, and control over auteurs is not what clearly Mel Brooks's was. The crazy thing is, this was the chit that allowed David Lynch to make Blue Velvet. He basically told Dino, I'll do this one for you. You got to do mine next. And you know, the rest is history.
He's like, don't worry, I'll bring most of the same cast. You don't recognize
Dean Stockwell got him under contract.
Dean Stockwell done. Vote.
Yes, the way we vote for things on this pod is screen it being the highest, even though we know that, you know, you have to watch this online now. But, you know, there's cool places like, I don't know, Vidiots and other theaters that might be putting it on screen. But then stream it is the next one, and skip it is self-explanatory. Who wants to start?
I find myself falling somewhere between screen it and stream it. Like, I do owe this movie one big screen viewing at this point, having not given it that yet. And I think it would reward that. At the same time, like, there is just so much that is so cuckoo bananas here. And that's a feature and not a bug. And I will say, I do love the fact that Alicia Witt, who pops up at the end of this movie as a little baby girl, has 1 foot in the David Lynch universe and 1 foot in the Hallmark Channel. And I'm like, you know, we need more of those in the world.
Also, more films need to end with an older woman screaming abomination at the little girl.
Agreed. I'd like everything to end that way. I'm available to be that old woman, should anyone need it.
Yes.
Next time someone adapts Little Women, Drea is there.
Yes! In your face, Joe March! I have to sadly admit, I'm in between stream it and skip it, largely because I did have to watch this in blocks. It was a lot to get through. I think knowledge of what's going on will help a lot. But there's so much, there's moments of charm, and there's a lot of performers I really like. And I'm in love with the fact that David Lynch and Kyle MacLachlan, like, ended up building a whole lingering career together. How exciting. Here's to whatever Denis Villeneuve can do with Timothée, should he ever exit puberty. but it was, there was a lot of this. And I honestly think the biggest problem was I watched it by myself. I do think it's more of a stream it for me if I can surround myself. As Guy suggested, you watch everything, really. If I had a couch full of gays, then go. I would be a stream it for sure.
Ooh.
Guy?
guy.
I think it's solidly a stream it. I think I saw this originally in the theater, but I think it is built for a VHS, honestly. Like, I don't know that these special effects benefit from, you know, an extra 12 feet. But I think that there are rich and magnificent performances here. There is juice and glory galore, and I think you should definitely stream it.
Guy, I asked the ongoing question, was it great or were you eight? And
the fact that said he was eight, Alonzo, it's right there. I love it.
Look. Howard the Duck, I was wrong, but this, I was right.
You need to go to the mattresses on this one.
Yeah. I think I'm going to screen it. I feel like this is a fun kind of cult classic-esque film that you can just kind of pop on and enjoy its weirdness and just, you know, Sting's commitment to being the crazy guy. Just it really feels like an era when they were like, okay, we're trying to nail these sci-fi movies, but we're happy with them being weird and out there, and that's like fun to see. There is that point of everything needing to be kind of like beige and black moving forward, or highly silver, and it's like, no, this can be. Sci-fi can be colorful and large and big characters. So, yes.
The cinematographer on Bros referred to Villeneuve's Dune as being the classiest hotel in Utah. Like, the aesthetic. It's just so true.
I just realized that if you knock the E off, you have the color palette of the Villeneuve movie. How did I miss that before?
Amazing.
Oh, man.
See, you thought our wordplay was only about doing it, and look at how much deeper it goes.
Okay. Well, on that note, I guess we'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
It's hard to explain what happens on Jordan, Jesse, Go.
So, I had my kids do it.
Saying swear words.
Bad jokes.
Maybe it's like you tell people that you're going to interview them, and then you just stay there like really quiet and try and creep them out.
It's just really boring.
Because of Jordan, right? Not me.
Because of both of you.
Oh.
Subscribe to Jordan, Jesse, Go.
A comedy show for grown-ups.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Guy Branum.
Drea Clark.
David Lynch is a revered and unique auteur. Dune is a revered and unique book series. But the pairing of Lynch and Dune is not the most obvious one in the world. Pitch an unexpected, high-risk pairing of auteur, director, and book series they'd adapt. It's okay if the series has already been adapted. As Dune Month will show... that's no reason for Hollywood not to take another big swing at something.
I have kind of a serious answer to this, and maybe it doesn't represent like as big of a gap between auteur and material as you would think, but I've said this for years and I still stand by it. Todd Haynes needs to adapt Valley of the Dolls.
Oh, yeah.
And he needs to adapt it the way he did Mildred Pierce for HBO, which is... page by page. Yeah. If you watch Mildred Pierce and then you read the book, it's like, oh man, he's not leaving anything out. It's all there. It is like one of the most faithful book to TV or film or anything adaptations I've ever seen in my life. So give him however many hours it takes to cover the 25-year, I want to say, span of what's covered, 20 at least, in Valley, as opposed to the quick in and out that we have gotten in adaptation so far. That just to me would be like, could die once I'd seen it all. Like, that's really all I'm living for at this point, is the possibility that Todd Haynes will take this material and just Todd Haynes the hell out of it. I think it would just be the most delicious thing ever.
I love that for you.
Yeah, and if it has to be a series, he can do Love Machine, and Once Is Not Enough when he's done.
Drea might be the only one who's tapped in on this, but that like Court of Thorn and Roses book that everyone's
Yes,
I want Lars von Trier to do that one. And buckle up, kiddos, we're going in. Oh, Gen Z, you don't like sex scenes? Too bad, Lars is about to get real slutty with it.
Lars is not afraid to get real slutty with it.
Not at all.
No, I like that because it's a
blend. But will they be depressing sex scenes?
But it won't be light. Yeah.
Oh, no, for sure.
My pitch is actually strangely has some crossover, just tonally, which is I looked at auteurs, who am I excited by? I've definitely spoken before of my love of Claire Denis. The Denis show today, double Denise. But Claire Denis, long history of really interesting work that has dug into masculinity, sexuality, weird futurism.
Colonialism.
Colonialism. Looking at people living in the world. You guys, Claire Denis needs to do the Interview with the Vampire series.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Good watch.
Like, I know that there, and I haven't seen them, that there's been a recent TV version that people responded well to or decently to. But we've talked here about the Tom Cruise misfire that had a lot of promise and a lot of male beauty in it to no fruition. Claire Denis will see that through. Like, if you take the woman who made Beau Travail and apply that to Lestat, that's what I'm looking for. And there will also be, she has that tactile element. Like, we talked about High Life as well. And if you were ever like, there's just not enough jizz in space, that is the movie for you. And that's the energy, I think, Interview with the Vampire. But Interview with the Vampire, on top of its fantastical themes, also has colonialism. It also has, you know, moving through history in ways that I think she could do. I'm just saying, someone give me her phone number and I will, keep up my Duolingo.
Get her and Anne Rice on a conference call.
Yeah, right? Get those crazy gals chatting it up. That's mine. All right. Guy.
For me, you know, it was so exciting to see Ryan Coogler come into the Marvel Cinematic Universe and do what he could. It's been so really awesome to watch female directors get to take, female superheroes. You know, a lot of the time, are they made to co-direct with a man? 100%.
Yeah, always.
But can we trust a lady to drive? Who knows? But we have not yet seen a iconically queer male MCU superhero. And so that is why I want to see North Star from the Uncanny X-Men, French-Canadian first out gay Marvel superhero. And the question is, which auteur do we put to the task? The answer is a 95-year-old James Ivory. I want $200 million to go to James Ivory to see him tell the small, beautiful story of this French-Canadian lad starting to understand his powers and his sexuality. Will Helena Bonham Carter have to come to set and still do hair like she did on Morris? 100%. Like, James Ivory isn't wasting money.
Alpha Flight is now wearing linen and tweed. It's going to be a bold new reimagining.
Right? Obviously, you had me at French-Canadian, as anyone could. Guy, follow-up question as your producer on this project.
Yes.
Who is the backup director that we have to have on set for insurance purposes?
I said the word Canadian, didn't I? We got Sarah Pauly there at all times. Will Sarah Pauly hide $7 million so she can make Marion Engel's iconic novel Bear into feature film about a lady fucking a bear? Yes, 100%. That's what this whole thing, it was all a heist to begin with.
Give me all of it.
I was trying to think of what, like, Ocean's 11, Mare owns, de Mare, the film years.
Can they steal it from Xavier Dolan? That would be my favorite in all of this, if that's possible. His CBC grant or something.
Perfect. That was fun. Thank you, Marissa. That was her idea.
Yeah. Yes. Another
just, excellent choice. I just wanted to explain. I don't just
and
like
once
casually
again,
yell
we're
out.
We're just throwing out all the good ideas for free, Hollywood.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
Don't be stealing them. But yes, thank you yet again, Marissa, for a fun segment. But now it's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
Well, there is a David Lynch movie on Disney Plus, a little film called The Straight Story, his 1999 drama that's about as undone as you can get. It stars the great Richard Farnsworth. He plays an elderly man who is living in Iowa. He finds out that his brother in Wisconsin has suffered a stroke and he wants to mend fences with him before either of them dies. And since he doesn't have a driver's license, what does he do? He drives his riding lawnmower from state to state and has adventures along the way. It's got a great Sissy Spacek performance. And it is like the one G-rated movie I think that David Lynch ever made. And it's beautiful and moving. And seriously, like, you know, in the back of his mind, he was having flashbacks about, like, you know, making sure the Fremen's suits were all on in the right way and that, you know, Francesca Annis was going to, like, hide her fillings the next time that she screamed. And so I'm sure it was, you know, I'm sure he had pleasure while making this and I get pleasure watching it.
I'll back up from the Midwestern point of view. A Straight Story is as Midwestern as Alexander Payne's Nebraska. It's legit. Mm. It knows its people. And if you are actually many parts of this country are like, oh yeah, I know a grandpa who would get on a tractor or a driving lawnmower and do that. That's our guy. Mine is a hard turn from there. And it's a Sundance title from this year that was one of my favorites that came out or is coming out this weekend called Love Lies Bleeding. Mm. It's Rose Glass's second film after Saint Maud. I was going to say Francis. Totally different movie.
Different movie.
Very different movie. It's wonderful.
Yeah, love.
Very different. Yeah, it stars Kristen Stewart and Katie O'Brien. Jenna Malone rocks up. Ed Harris with the best / worst wig you've ever seen. And it's bloody. It is sexy. It's in the 80s. Katie O'Brien plays this bodybuilder who's like, you know, wandering.
Oh, it's that movie. Yeah, that's supposed to be really good.
Yeah, wandering through town. I tend to try and recommend the better films.
and we thank you for it.
Yeah, and Kristen Stewart's a gym manager and daughter of this sort of crime, small town crime lord. Anyway, it's pulpy and all sorts of things. It's exciting. It's exciting filmmaking, and I'm thrilled Rose Glass is on a very cool trajectory. Nice. Go check it out.
Yes, I've been super hyped about that. You know, any film with buff people is great. Kylie O'Brien, Katie's wife, has been the biggest cheerleader online. And, you know, I'm going to go get a lift in with Katie. That's already in the books. So nice. Just know, the meatheads, we rise up.
You might want to do that before you watch her sex scenes, because I always like a clearer mind of like, oh, your eyes are up there. That
yeah.
kind of
oh,
situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Guy, what do you got?
Okay. So as you guys know, I've spent like the last 4 years working on an adaptation of Babette's Feast.
Yes.
Two of the three people here have helped me with it. Iffy, you will be called into service at some point in time. But it means I have to go watch all the food movies. And there is a new, very French food movie called The Taste of Things that is from Tran Anh Hung, the guy who made The Scent of Green Papaya like 30 years ago, which wasn't a thing that I understood until I got to the end of this very strange movie that communicates through cooking more than anything else. It is a deliciously beautiful movie, and however much, you know, Big Night, Babette's Feast, there are so many of these movies that are about cooking, but this movie uses cooking more than dialogue to communicate a relationship. You also have Juliette Binoche and Benoit Magimel, her ex-husband, playing lovers, partners. Like, fundamentally, this is a movie about a relationship and what it means to these two people and what working together means to two people. and it's so good. Nothing will make you want braised lettuce and a partner equal to your skills as much as this movie.
Here, here. I back it up.
Seconded. Yeah, no, that's it. It is so good. And don't see it on an empty stomach, as with most of these movies.
Oh, God. I can't tell you how unsatisfying popcorn will be. Popcorn's never been less satisfying than in The Taste of Things.
Oh, yeah. You know, I decided to just pick a movie from 1984 since this film came out from 1984. So, you know, we'll go with the Hugh Wilson joint, Police Academy. Go ahead and watch that. There's a lot of films that I watch primarily on the treadmill at LA Fitness because AMC cannot stop running them. It takes me back to the childhood when you saw a whole movie just through segments that you just kept running into. And it's nostalgic in that way. And Police Academy, a joy. Now, Gods of Egypt, not as much of a joy. And I'm like, I'm like, what is this movie? Like,
I love that Police Academy. It's funny because 84, like that summer and even some of that Christmas, and I worked at a movie theater, like it was my last year of high school. Police Academy went from being an R-rated comedy with blowjobs to being like a cute, family-friendly PG franchise to eventually a TV cartoon. And I'm just thinking, like, what kids were like big fans of the Police Academy franchise who at some point their parents had to be like, yeah, you don't get to see the first one.
So weird. This was recently on TV when I was visiting my friend Tessa, and I kept glancing up, like it was just sort of muted in the background, and it was like they were my extended family. I was like, oh, Mahoney. Oh, yeah. Hightower.
Oh, yeah.
Tackleberry. Yeah. I knew so many more character names than I ever thought I knew.
I'm definitely going to remake that bun in the oven crop top for this summer. I need it so bad. I was like, oh, yes. I was like, this was like the moment, baby, when the crops were out, you know?
And nobody gooted like the goot.
All right. Well, big thank you to Guy Branum. What do you have going on that listeners should look out for?
Oh, I, as part of Netflix is a Joke, I have a show at the Elysian on May 7th here in LA. So people should come to that.
Sweet. Yeah.
Yay.
As a Guy fan myself, I agree. You gotta see Guy in person. You'll be laughing so hard, you'll feel good.
That's your tagline?
Yeah, you'll be laughing so hard, you feel good.
It was that.
Take that one back to the drawing board, I think.
Well, my tagline is, of course, abomination!
Oh, well, Andrea and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. And the listeners, thank you for listening yet again. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels, which are all linked in the show notes. In week 2 of Dune Month, we're going to be talking about the pilot episode of Sci-Fi's miniseries, Frank Herbert's Dune. Our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun. A worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.